Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So here's something. It turns out that a company can, in fact, be a big fat jerk. And also that what everybody thinks is a really big story really might not be. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., Marketplace East, if you will. I'm Kai Rizdal. Great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It is the 18th of November. We begin today with a story that is pretty much all at the same time of lasting political, economic, environmental, and symbolic import. Or perhaps it's not. The Keystone XL pipeline that would carry hundreds of thousands of barrels of crude oil from the Canadian tar sands across the Great Plains down to the Gulf of Mexico. The fight against Keystone has been a marquee battle for the U.S. environmental movement for years now. It is seen as key to the political future of Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana, who is still wrapped up in a tough reelection fight in a state, of course, where the energy industry is a major, major employer. But all of that aside, it might not actually matter whether the thing goes ahead at all. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
The fight against Keystone was primarily about preventing climate change.
Crude oil from the oil sands is a lot more carbon intense.
That's Jim Crane. He's an energy studies fellow at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. He says you emit more carbon just extracting the stuff, and it throws off extra carbon when you burn it. The hope was blocking Keystone could prevent this type of crude from getting to market. But in the years that Keystone's been debated, that train has left the station. Literally, trains. That's how the oil is finding its way to market. Keith Brownsey is a political scientist at Mount Royal University in Alberta, Canada.
It's being transported now by train down to Vancouver, and it's being put on tankers, and it's shipped over to Asia. Bingo, there you go.
The original pro-Keystone argument has also lost a lot of steam. That was energy independence for North America. Fracking made that a less urgent concern. However, for Brownsey, putting the oil in a pipeline now matters for a new reason.
Rail is exponentially more dangerous than transmitting it by pipeline.
In other words, pipelines don't derail. Andrew Weaver is a climate scientist at the University of Victoria and a Green Party legislator for British Columbia.
It's kind of like the polar bear. You know, Keystone has become that iconic image of, if we can't force change here, where can we force change?
While Weaver opposes Keystone, he admits the battle is largely symbolic at this point. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Uber is, for the uninitiated, the car-sharing app that has kind of become a verb, as in, I Ubered home from work last night. The company has also become something of a shining example, and I mean that in the most unflattering possible way, of questionable corporate behavior. The most recent example became public last night, an incident in which a senior executive at the company suggested spending $1 million to investigate the personal lives of journalists, in particular, one female reporter. Uber CEO Travis Kalanick did take to Twitter today with an apology, but Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has more now on bad behavior and the bottom line.
It's not just this misstep. There was an ad campaign in France that promised attractive female drivers. A quote from the CEO in GQ about Boober, i.e. how popular he's become with women. Robert Sutton is a professor of management science at Stanford University and the author of a book called The No Rule.
In our society, and I wish this wasn't true, we seem to forgive, reward, and even celebrate excessively, so long as they make money.
Sutton offers the example of Dove Charney, the founder of American Apparel, who ran the company for years despite allegations of sexual harassment and lewd behavior. And yeah, a quick poll of Uber customers in Washington, D.C. showed a kind of meh reaction.
I don't know. I mean, it'd have to cross a significant ethical line for it to change my consumer habit. Sounds really terrible, but...
But Uber customer Rebecca Milford will probably keep using the app. Chris Allen, too.
Like, as a customer, it's pretty good service, so I wouldn't be too worried about any issues. It works well for me.
But Karen North at the USC Annenberg School of Communications thinks Uber's profits could suffer if the company burns through the trust it's built with customers.
They need to push people to trust their app and their drivers rather than just a standard cab company. And so if you start feeling like this is an untrustworthy organization or group of people, then it hits to the core of why people are interested in using these ride shares.
She says a competitor could easily lure consumers away by marketing itself as the nicer, safer, more polite version of Uber. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
If you want drama in the news business, who did what to whom and when did they do it, there is no better place to turn than the network morning shows. All of which is to say there is trouble once again at the Today Show. The hotshot young programmer that NBC literally just brought in to turn that show around and get it back on top of the oh-so-lucrative ratings heap has himself been turned around and is now out the door. Good Morning America is at the moment number one in network TV morning news talk entertainment land. But as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, both shows are slowly losing ground as audiences change and viewers move away from broadcast television.
You want to see the morning shows skirmishing for ratings, trying to attract the key 18 to 34-year-old demographic? Here goes.
I'm trying to get George to dance. That's my
George, you got, I'm here, dog. You got to get up.
George Stephanopoulos, host of ABC's Good Morning America, stepping out a bit awkwardly with rapper Lil Jon. Over at rival NBC, meanwhile, Today Show host Matt Lauer has boy band One Direction. Band member Zayn Malik is missing, and Lauer asks,
is it something more serious than just a minor illness? There have been rumors of substance abuse. What's going on?
Then the audience booed, and younger viewers slammed Lauer on social media. Here's entertainment blogger Jim Hill.
Those are the people they need to grow the Today Show audience. And, you know, here Matt has managed to drive a whole generation away.
At the same time, the networks need to keep their older traditional audience members who watch over a morning cup of coffee to get the headlines and a bit of lighter fare. Brian Steinberg at Variety says ABC has nailed the formula.
ABC, Good Morning America, knows who it is. It's a single-minded, it's an entertainment show with a little bit of news thrown in there. Today, I think, is a little more of a split personality. They want to be a news show, but they also want to entertain and have the same kind of fun. It's not just hard to pivot.
Thing is, the shows really aren't that different, and their ratings are still pretty close, says equity analyst Tuna Amobi at S&P Capital IQ.
The overall audience has been declining. I think being number one, it's more or less a bragging rights.
Bragging rights do matter, though, with advertisers, which is nice for number one ABC because these morning shows deliver huge profits to the networks. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, more record highs, if that even means anything anymore. I just don't know. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There is one thing upon which all else in retail hinges. Not supply and not demand, although they are involved. I am talking here about price. And along those lines, the internet has pretty much been a godsend. There are aggregator sites for stuff like airline tickets. You can get pricing data on cars pretty easily online. There's practically instant price transparency for commodities if you choose to go that way. So why then can't we get the same thing for umbrellas or teapots? Or sweaters. As part of our occasional collaboration with the New York Times, called in this incarnation A Guide to Buying Just About Anything, Sally Herships has the story.
For this story, we are going shopping to Century 21 in New York. I'm with Elise Ariel. She's 37, a legal assistant. I need a pair of gloves, and Ariel wants to check out DVS.
What is that?
Oh, Sally. Give me your girl card. Just give it to me right now.
Ariel wants to buy Diane von Furstenberg,
the creator of the greatest garment ever made for women ever, the wrap dress.
But she doesn't want to pay designer prices, so you would think she would love nothing more than transparent pricing, shopping the same way you do for plane tickets, except for one thing.
So how do you feel about sales?
How do I feel about sales? Oh, like a moth to a flame.
It's about the hunt for me, and when there's something I've been eyeing and I see it went on sale, then it's like God just sort of put it there for me.
Taking away sales can mean taking the fun out of shopping for consumers. Some don't want transparent pricing. Just look at JCPenney, Ron Johnson, the former CEO, decided the chain would offer transparent pricing and stop offering sales. So consumers stopped shopping. That's according to Barbara Kahn. She teaches marketing at Wharton.
You've got to give them a reason to buy. So fashion does that. Innovation does that.
So, says Kahn, do sales.
And if the sale wasn't there, well, maybe they wouldn't go to the store that day.
Kahn says for discounters, slashing prices is key. But for other retailers, sales are meant to be special. If retailers offer transparent pricing, it means shoppers are comparing products based on price, which means, for the retailer, a downward spiral of discounts. Most retailers don't want transparent pricing. And even if they did, and if you're the kind of consumer who hates shopping and loves price aggregators, remember, transparency means a lot of information. Kelly Goldsmith is an assistant professor of marketing at the Kellogg School of Management.
Consumers always think they want the most information, right? We think we want to have all access to know everything about everything in the consumer space. And in reality, when we know everything about everything, it is exhausting.
Should we buy new or used, local or national? Should we get that warranty? Goldsmith says if we're bombarded with too much information, it can decrease the odds of our buying anything. She says also, be careful what you wish for. Sometimes we don't want to know what we just bought is available for less.
If I want to buy an Hermes Birkin bag or I want to buy a Louis Vuitton bag or something high end, I don't want to think that it could be 20% off someplace else, right? I don't want to know that. You don't want to see how the sausage is made, right? There's downsides. There's downsides from information.
Goldsmith says often consumers buy luxury products to make themselves feel fancy. Seeing a price tag marked half off could make you feel like a chump. But for all products, high or low end, even with the ability to compare prices, which is what transparent pricing offers, how do we really know if we're getting a good deal? Take a t-shirt from Kanye West, the rapper. The price is $120, but what did it cost to make?
Is that really cost significantly more than a t-shirt that you would get at the Gap for $25? How could it?
Josh Pollack is with Parker Avery Group, a retail price consulting firm.
What could they possibly do to it? I mean, spin gold dust into it?
Pollack says the truth is we don't know.
The t-shirt from Walmart and the t-shirt from the Gap aren't the same t-shirt. And you need to be super expert at the construction of t-shirts and the shipping of t-shirts and the marketing of t-shirts in order to determine whether one retailer was making extra margin off of you compared to the other one.
LEK, another retail price consulting company, says there's only a few areas where we've boiled down our understanding of a product, like plane tickets, to such a limited set of factors that we can really be confident of transparency, of accurately comparing prices. And often, shopping can be a lot more complicated than just price, which I experienced when I was trying to pick out a pair of gloves. These make my hands look fat.
I don't make your hands look fat. That's amazing. What you need to do is just, like, bedazzle them. Maybe put, like, a big S on one and, like, an H.
In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Do these make my hands look fat? How great was that? Our collaboration with the New York Times, a guide to buying just about anything, is on the air here and on the Marketplace Morning Report. It is online tonight. And then the actual newspaper tomorrow. Check it out. We have said, I don't know how many times on this program, that this is a consumer-driven economy. Consumers, as in you, of course. So with that in mind, we have been asking you what your economy feels like. The response so far has honestly been great. Today, Markovich Drummond from Buena Park, California.
My economy's rebounding. It's rebounding slowly, but it's coming back. And it looks a lot different post-recession. When my job went away in 2008, I was a radio production director. I wasn't especially concerned, but by 2010, our savings had been exhausted. So we sold our house, moved to a small apartment, and I took some IT training, and that helped me land a contract position as a printer technician with an aerospace company and another part-time job with the Academy of Radio Broadcasting in Huntington Beach. My strategy has been to forego trying to land that one fantastic job and see how many more modest income streams I can cobble together. I'm managing to keep the bills paid, managing to keep the pantry stocked. Of my three sons, two were still living at home, but one moved out in July, so I'm saving a little money there as well. And his brother shares the apartment with me and the cat and kicks in a few hundred dollars every month for household expenses. So that's a big help. If things continue to sputter along like this for another 5 or 6 years, I'm sure retirement is not even going to be in the equation. But, you know, strangely enough, I'm enjoying life a lot more than before the recession. It's been a real revelation to find out all the things that I can do without and step off of that consumer hamster wheel.
Stories of your economy don't work without you, so drop us a line, would you? There is a way for you to do that on our homepage. It's marketplace.org. Coming up.
I think I've learned to embrace the word ambition over time.
Indeed, she has. Designer Tory Burch straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Record highs again as the Dow Industrials added 40 points, a quarter of 1%, 17,687. The NASDAQ cranked up 31 points, two-thirds of 1%, 4702. The S&P 500 fired up 10 points, about a half percent, finished at an all-time high of 2051. Healthcare had a good day. HCA Holdings jogged up 2.2% today. HealthNet hiked 1.4%. Ford down a quarter percent after the company announced it recalled 65,000 Fusion models thanks to ignition key issues. Home Depot reported a better-than-expected quarterly profit, but still dropped more than 2%. Manchester United, oh no, released earnings that were way off target. The company's shares fell 0.9%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for October. Retailer Target releases quarterly earnings. And a House Natural Resources Subcommittee holds a hearing on volcano hazards, exploring the national preparation and response strategy. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you're a Pizza Hut aficionado, boy, is this your week. The country's biggest pizza chain is taking a hint from the fast casual frontrunners, restaurants like Chipotle and Chopped. Starting tomorrow, Pizza Hut is going to let customers design their own pies. From KERA in Dallas, Lauren Silverman explains why.
This one here is the cherry pepper bombshell, and you can
Carrie Walsh pops open the cardboard box to reveal what looks like artisan pizza. Thin crust topped with bright green spinach and red Peruvian peppers. There's even a spiral drizzle of balsamic to draw you in. Walsh, Pizza Hut's chief marketing officer, says there are 11 new specialty recipes, 10 new crust topper flavors, including sriracha and ginger boom boom, 4 drizzles, and a skinny lineup for the calorie concerned.
In fact, there are now 2 billion ways at Pizza Hut that you can customize your pie.
Yep, she said 2 billion ways to put together your pizza. I didn't ask for the math. So why let customers play mad scientist with each pie?
The reality is today's consumer is looking to experience an adventure. Pizza is America's favorite food. We thought it only made sense to bring new flavor experiences to pizza.
I think they're trying to do too much too soon.
Rich Dupre writes about fast casual dining for The Motley Fool. He says since sales at Pizza Hut have been declining for 2 years, they did need to sprinkle in a little spice, not drop in the whole bottle.
People are going to be going into there and having this Cheesecake Factory type menu before them. And I think Sales 101 says you keep it simple.
Pizza Hut's comeback strategy does follow the larger customization trend. Even McDonald's and Taco Bell, companies that built their brand on taste reliability, are testing the build-your-own-order technique. But Pizza Hut's revamp is much bigger. And Dupre wonders about that order of a meatball and premium salami pizza with buffalo sauce, sliced banana peppers, fresh spinach on a salted pretzel crust with a honey sriracha drizzle.
How is that going to affect the time factor in placing orders and handling the customers?
So, to keep out chaos in the kitchen, Pizza Hut also undertook its biggest training endeavor.
We actually had over 1,000 above restaurant leaders come here to our headquarters in Texas
to learn the fastest ways to cook cockadoodle bacon and pretzel piggy pies. Employees will also have a more laid-back look. t-shirts and blue jeans instead of polo shirts and black pants. Critics are calling the overhaul frantic rebranding, but Walsh swears the idea isn't half-baked. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Ten years ago, not too many people knew who Tory Burch was. Then she opened a store in Manhattan and a website to go with it, and now she is Tory Burch, fashion brand name with a capital B, clothes and shoes and jewelry. Today, there are more than 125 retail stores and a parallel foundation, and now a spiffy new coffee table book called Tory Burch in Color. Tory, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Orange is your favorite color.
One of them, for sure.
One of them? Come on. No, it's the first one in the book. Come on.
It is my favorite color, but I have some others. But orange is my favorite color. Happy color.
This is, it's an impactful book visually, right? There's all kinds of good stuff in here. And I guess the question is, in a way, it's almost like the Pinterest of coffee table books, right? You took all this stuff that you like and you slapped it in this book.
Well, thank you.
Is that true? I
do love Pinterest. So, you know, we weren't looking at Pinterest when we thought about the book, but we thought it would be interesting to bring our blog to life in a book form. The book I wanted to do was about 7 years ago, and it was on entrepreneurship and women in business, and met with many publishers, and they didn't have an interest. They said women in business books don't sell. So we started working.
They actually said that to you?
They said that. It was before all these women in business books have come out. And so I didn't want to do a typical fashion book. I wanted to do a book where we would give people a window into our world and what inspires us.
You guys started digitally early on, right? You opened the website and the digital side of your house at the same time, in essence, that you opened the brick and mortar side, right? And now here you are in a world of social media, in a book that you took favorably, a comparison to Pinterest with. Does social media change your outlook on how you do fashion?
It does. When we started the business, we had very little budget, so we had to be very crafty in how we could build the business. Social media was a big part of that, and that's why we launched e-commerce in tandem with our first store. We looked at it as another place to speak to our customer. It was another outlet for sales, but it was also a way that we could engage and have customer engagement and be a form of advertising.
Did you have the ambition then that would get you to this point, do you think?
So in retrospect, yes. I hear myself sometimes and I'm a little embarrassed by saying I want to build a global lifestyle brand so that I could start a foundation. And if I knew what it would take, I would never have said that because I didn't know what it would take. And 10 years later, that's what we've done. But it's been a tremendous pleasure, but a lot of hard work.
Tell me about the foundation then. I mean, what you guys are trying to do and what motivates you in that?
So when I went to raise money for the company initially, I said, you know, I wanted to start this foundation, and I was told never to talk about business and social responsibility in the same sentence. Wow. And I would say I went
That's
the opposite
amazing,
of that.
Right?
It is amazing in retrospect, but I knew it would be about women and children. After doing some research, we thought, well, we did a startup that could really be helpful for other women entrepreneurs. And that's what the genesis was. So we support women entrepreneurs through low-cost capital, through entrepreneurial education and mentorship.
Is it about being openly ambitious?
I think I've learned to embrace the word ambition over time. 10 years ago, our first article, a good friend of mine called and she said it was a great article, but you shied away from the word ambition.
Yeah.
And over the last 10 years, I've learned to embrace ambition, and I'm trying to get other women to do the same if they want to.
Right, right. Well, right. I was in an interview the other day with a woman who is almost literally a rocket scientist. And we were talking about a bunch of rocket science stuff. And then somebody who was watching that interview accused me of mansplaining to her. And I mentioned that for this reason. Do you find it still to this day, even after all you have done, that men mansplain your business to you?
So, of course, the other night I was at an event, not the other night, a few months ago, and I was introduced as a female CEO. And I
Make
got
you crazy?
Well, I just thought it was funny. I got up and I started laughing and I said, you know, I've never heard a man being introduced as a male CEO. And so that's got to change.
What is left for you to do? I mean, you're huge, right? What is left for you to do but to become that worldwide brand that you want to be?
For us, we're just beginning. We will be launching Sport next year, which is a whole new world.
Wow.
With one freestanding store and e-commerce as well. As you know, we just launched watches. Mm-hmm. And but that said, just building the businesses that we have and building our footprint carefully, strategically, and slowly. I think restraint is a word we've always used for the last 10 years, and we'll continue to.
Tori Burch of the company with the same name, the brand of the same name, and the book called In Color. Tori, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, in which Uber proves to be just that little extra bit ickier than we all might have already thought that it was. On the company's blog is this item. It's from a couple of years ago, to be fair, but in light of recent developments, it does resonate all the more. It's an entry called Rides of Glory. Consider it, I don't know, the Uber equivalent of the walk of shame, if you know what I mean. They took their rider data, Uber did, sorted it for anybody who took an Uber between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m. on a Friday or a Saturday night, and then took another ride from at or near the previous night's drop-off anywhere from 4 to 6 hours later. So you think about that for a second, and here's what that means. Uber can, and apparently does, or at least has, track one-night stands. Ew. All right, we're done. That's it. The Dow up 40 points today, about 0.25%. The NASDAQ up 31 points, 2/3 of 1%. The S&P 500 gained 10 points, about 0.5%. Our special projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Raghu Manavalan and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.